On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I want to welcome you all to this evening's program with Margaret Warner. Margaret is the one of five senior correspondents at the NewsHour. She's also lead correspondent for its overseas reporting. And in the past couple of years, she has been to almost every country you can think of. She's been reporting from Afghanistan, from Brazil, from China, from Iraq, from Kenya, from South Korea, Pakistan, Russia, and probably many more, but I will leave it at that. In 2008, she won an Emmy Award for her coverage of turmoil in Pakistan. And prior to joining the NewsHour, she was a print journalist. She used to be with Newsweek and, in fact, spent a decade there as a White House reporter and as chief diplomatic correspondent. So please join me in welcoming Margaret Warner. Now, Margaret, I'm going to open with, just because you've had so much recent coverage from Egypt and from North Africa more broadly, and give us a sense of your view of whether is this the Facebook revolution, the Twitter revolution, as some people say? What is the role of new media in it?
The role of new media, I think, and Jane, first of all, it's a pleasure to be here and with your fabulous audience, so thank you. This is not just a Twitter revolution. I mean, it's a nice shorthand. The role of the new media was huge, but it did not either cause the uprising or determine the outcome, but it enabled it. And so would we have had the revolution without this whole Arab Spring, as they still call that in the region, even though we've moved beyond spring, but this series of uprisings? I still think it was going to happen eventually, but certainly I think the way it crystallized in so many countries, new media had a big role. So let's take Egypt as an example. There, what you had was the role of new media accelerated what was building, which was the sense by the public over 30 years that that their country was falling behind, that they were ruled by a regime that was not only autocratic and self-dealing, but had no respect for them. And two events had happened, you may recall, just last fall, in last November and December, that sort of drove this home to Egyptians. One was they had these total sham elections from the end of November to early December, parliamentary ones, that the Mubarak regime so blatantly stole that they won like 97% of the seats in parliament, which they hadn't won 5 years ago. The difference was this time that people were going around with their little cell phone cameras and actually filming what was going on at polling places and posting this. That was new. Then in December, you had what happened in Tunisia, and by now you're all familiar with the story. The young vegetable seller, cart peddler, who is insulted deeply by a policewoman and then by city officials and completely decides to douse himself with gasoline and set himself on fire, and that lit a fire in Tunisia. And by early January, Ben Ali, the longtime ruler, was gone. Again, the impact in Egypt was huge. I mean, they consider Tunisia nothing but a rival in soccer, but the tweets between the two countries and all these young people who were connected were, you know, okay, now let's all gather down at the Egyptian embassy in Tunis and demand that Mubarak leave. I mean, it was like an electrical charge. The irony is that the Mubarak regime had sowed the seeds themselves. And that all came out of, in 2002, there was this Arab Development Report that the UN helped sponsor that identified that the Arab world had completely fallen behind, that you had 22 countries despite all the oil wealth, a combined GDP less than Spain's. That was a stunning 5% of the world's population published only 1% of the books, and they were mostly religious. That 1.5%, only 1.5% of the population even had internet access. And that it was all due to a lack of freedom. And so these regimes, Mubarak and many other Arab countries, sort of got the message that for economic development, they had to open up. And so they started granting cell phone licenses, internet service provider licenses, and the response was huge. So in the 10 years between essentially 2002, really, and last January, for instance, internet use in Egypt went from less than 1% to 21%. Now, that doesn't sound huge until you realize most of those were the people in the 15 to 45 group. And if you really do the math and look at the statistics, which I've done, that was a huge percentage of that age cohort. So suddenly you had all these young people in all these countries connected and communicating with one another. And as they saw the world, they realized what they were missing out on. And so when that said, I don't think you would have had the uprising if you hadn't also had mainstream organizations who have been active all the time, labor, and even these sort of neutered but still somewhat active liberal opposition parties. And certain websites and movements started to spring up. But the so-called one of these groups, the April 6th movement, a Facebook website, started organizing a labor protest in 08. And it built from there into a general protest movement against the regime. And then in 2010, you may have heard of this website called We Are All Khaled Said started. And that was a young man brutally beaten in Alexandria by the police, captured on both on video, it turned out, but really just the photographs of the man's brother when he went to the morgue. And he posted it on the internet, and this young Google executive, Egyptian, living in Dubai, saw it and was so stunned that he anonymously started a website called We're All Khaled Said. And the brilliance was, he didn't just rant and rave about what happened to Khaled Said, he said, send me your own experiences, video and photos of police brutality. And the response was huge. And by last January, in less than 6 months, it had 400,000 members. And again, it created this sense of community. And so when they called this demonstration on January 25th, specifically because it's Let's Honor Our Police Day, that's the day it was, both traditional organizers and the Facebook crowd joined forces. And this woman named Gamila Ismail, who for a long time had been organizing protests for the release of her husband from prison, which I won't go into his whole story, but he's one who, Ayman Nour, dared to run against Mubarak in elections in 05. She said she was so used to having, they'd call protests and there'd be 200 people on a street corner. And she said, we'd call out to people across the street and said, come join us, we're fighting for you, for political freedoms. And she said, I'd see in their eyes they were with us, but they wouldn't join us. So anyway, January 25th comes around, and the plan was they'd have people in like five different squares around the city, and they'd organize a march. They'd all start marching at the same time toward Tahrir, and they'd call out to the apartment buildings, come join us. And she said, this time, even when we gathered in this, I don't remember which square, usually there are more thugs than there are of us. There were more of us than the thugs being the hired goons for the government. And then we started walking down the street, and I actually always get goosebumps thinking about what she said. We started calling out to people, and they started coming out of the buildings, joining us. And it was as if they were coming out of the ground, she said. And what you had, and by the time they got to Tahrir, there were tens, if not hundreds of thousands. I mean, she couldn't count it. So you see, what you had there was a marriage of traditional organizations suddenly given this sort of rocket booster by the new media. So just getting, so it isn't that the uprising was caused by it, but it enabled it, provided the spark.
Yeah. Say a little more about Wael Ghanim. This is the Googler, the young Google marketing executive. He was Egyptian born, but he was actually working in UAE.
Dubai.
Yeah, and but then took time off to go and start this Facebook and be part of Facebook page. My understanding is that he was detained.
This is after, once the revolution got underway, yes, he came back, he took leave. But the whole time he created the page, he stayed in Dubai. But yes, go ahead.
Yeah. So then he came back, he did take part in the initial January 25th event in Tahrir Square. He was then imprisoned for 12 days.
Yes.
And he missed 12 days of this, then came back out. Tell us about he had an interview then with the broadcast media at that point.
The reason this is an interesting story is it shows also the role that mainstream media played. And we haven't talked about that. But the fact that there was Al Jazeera network, because you see, the Mubarak government had also decided they couldn't have Egypt cut off from the world. And so even though this is state television that just played, you know, typical state television, they had allowed Al Jazeera in, as well as Al Arabiya. So during the uprising, Al Jazeera is broadcasting, while state television is broadcasting complete pablum, you know, and sort of, I don't know, patriotic songs. And people are looking out their windows and seeing these, you know, things going on in the street, and then the police brutality that occurred, attacks in Tahrir, all of this is broadcast not so much by social media as the mainstream. So when Wael Ghanim came back, his role still, the regime didn't really understand his role, but at about day three or four, they suddenly realized this was the guy who done We Are All Khaled Saeed page. So they did, they detained him. And he went missing, but no, most people didn't know who he was to start with. All right, so he's finally let out, and this is now the Monday, I guess it was February 5th. So you're 2 weeks into the revolution. I was there at the time. It was really starting to lose steam. And when we went out in the streets and talked to people, they'd say, you know, the kids have done a great job. Mubarak's not going to run again. It's now time to get back to work. Let's, you know, this is great what they've done. But there was a sense that there was sort of a yearning for order. And the people in the square were starting to feel they were losing the momentum. So Wael Ghanim is let free, and he agrees to an interview by another private channel called Dream TV. And so they're sitting just as we are, and she's interviewing him about his experience. And he's very, not complaining, he says, well, you know, yes, I was detained, but I wasn't mistreated. I explained to them that we're all just young people who care about our country. We're not being paid by foreign power and so on. Then at one point he reveals that he was blindfolded this whole 12 days. Mm-hmm. And people who watched it in Arabic suddenly found that kind of stunning. You know, I mean, if he'd said it at the beginning, it would have been one thing. But here he wasn't complaining, and then he said, well, I was actually in the dark for 12 days. And she, you know, she kind of said, what do you mean? Well, I was blindfolded. So they'd taken this blindfold off. So that was the first kind of amazing moment, and this was occurred in the evening. Then she said, well, did they tell you about all the people who were killed? And he said, well, the last night when they brought me in for interrogation, they did tell me that a lot of people were killed. And she said, well, we're not supposed to show this, but I showed this last night. And suddenly this video started running in front of him and also for the audience of young people's faces, all the people who'd been killed. You know, many with sniper fire. I mean, I saw photographs from families in Tahrir. You know, it was always dead center. I mean, these were professional snipers. And he starts looking, and she gave this impassioned sort of elegy for these young people. And these are our flower, our youth. And, you know, did they tell you about this whale? And he started looking at this, and he started to cry. I always get teary when I think of it. And she said, you know, these young men, and it's very dramatic. You can actually Google this if you want to watch this. And so he was looking at this, and he said, I had no idea. I had no idea. He said, we never intended this to happen. We didn't want this to happen. This is caused by people who don't want to, who couldn't let go of power. And he was almost apologizing to the parents of these young people. And finally, he just said, he was crying and crying, and she's saying, don't stop, don't cry. And finally, he ripped his mic off, and he said, I have to go. And he literally flees from the studio. Well, I didn't watch this because I can't understand Dream TV, but I called that night someone I touch base with regularly, whose name I won't use, but a very well-connected Egyptian, very well-connected, sort of diplomatically in government. And he said, Margaret, have you seen what happened on Dream TV? I said, what are you talking about? And he said, everybody's calling everybody. And what it did was suddenly it started playing on this loop. And everyone started calling everyone and saying, look at Dream TV, and then I think Al Jazeera picked it up. It totally reignited the revolution. And people start tweeting, and you know, that we were running out of gas, and now we're back. And sure enough, 5 days later, Mubarak was gone. And so to me, other than being an amazing moment, and if you just Google literally Wael Gonim Dream TV, there are a million websites. Don't watch the short YouTube version. There are longer ones. You want to watch like a 10-minute version. There's a wonderful one with subtitles. It was the marriage of both new media and the old media, because it hadn't been on Dream TV and it had just been on the internet. Average middle-aged people wouldn't have seen it. So that really crystallized, as I said, and that's why you can't just call it a Twitter or Facebook revolution, and yet he had so much to do with it,
And he said during that interview, he said, this revolution belonged to the internet youth, then it belonged to the Egyptian youth, then it belonged to Egypt. Is there something like that?
That's right.
So it's this wonderful encapsulation of what it's about.
And he has retained a lot of influence. For instance, when I was there, I went back in September and went back right as Ramadan ended. And people had been fairly patient about the military, the SCAF, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces that's running the country. The sense was, okay, when Ramadan's over, we better move on to the next phase. We want to complete the revolution. It's not just an uprising. You have to put a democracy in place. So when I went back, after about a couple of weeks, and the military still hadn't set a date for the elections, and it really looked like it appeared to Egyptians as if they were trying to hold on to power. I'll leave that to the Egyptians to determine. They obviously decided so. And Wael Gonim wrote also an open letter to the leader of the armed forces and said, it is time to call for elections, He doesn't want to get in politics. I think he's back with Google, but he retains tremendous moral authority.
So now we've had the parliamentary elections, at least, and the Muslim Brotherhood's party, the Freedom and Justice Party, won about 40% of the vote. What next?
Well, the shocker, the stunner to most Egyptians and observers is that the number two party was not a liberal secular party, though if you combined all of them, they would have been number two, but you didn't combine all of them because they were so fractured. It was this party of the Salafists, who are way more doctrinaire, way more fundamentalist than the Muslim Brotherhood in their view of whether the state should enforce a social code, an Islamic social code. I mean, that's really the fine line. So even though right now we're in the midst, just to briefly explain, it's a complicated election process, but at stake in this first round were a third of the districts, a third of the, they call them governance, but provinces. So today and tomorrow is the runoff for all the seats where nobody got 50%, but the runoff is usually between a Brotherhood person and a Salafi. So you're going to end up with the Brotherhood having a large, I don't know if they'll have a majority, but a huge dominant plurality. They have quickly rushed to reassure the world and Egyptians that they don't want to make a coalition with the Salafis. They want to make a coalition with one or two of the secular parties. And in fact, they're in a bloc anyway, not a bloc, I shouldn't call it that, because there's something called the Egyptian bloc. They're in this democratic alliance that has some secular parties in it. But I think that they're going to be forced to define how they feel about this very delicate issue of enforcing the social code through government way sooner than they wanted to. Mm-hmm. And there's a difference within the Muslim Brotherhood. When I was there, I could not get someone in the Brotherhood to give me a definitive answer on where they stood on this, including I went to interview Essam Alarian, who's the number one person on their slate. And finally, another fellow named Amr Hamzawi, who's sort of an intellectual and actually won very big, he also ran, everyone runs for parliament, it seems. He said, look, there's a reason, Margaret, you can't get a straight answer because they haven't determined it. And now they're going to have to decide. And I don't know which way that's going to go. I mean, the Brotherhood is a group of, there are a lot of just middle class professionals in that group. But we know they've been a social organization, a social service organization, and the one organization that could flourish even under the Mubarak regime. But they never had to come to terms with what it would mean if they could govern. They never imagined they could govern.
So we've never known what their governing philosophy was because they didn't need one. Yeah.
And it also depend, I think, on the secular activists. Do they now, if they really coalesce, they won't have the votes in parliament But they need to really get their act together. And what we did find was a lot of the young people who were involved in the Twitter side of the revolution did not want to get involved in elective politics. You know, it's kind of grubby, gritty work. And while it's wonderful, I mean, there's a young woman who was very active who wants to do do NGO work, and that's what she's doing. And that's fine, but the Brotherhood kept their eye on the ball, and it was about gaining political power through the ballot box.
And we didn't see, did we not see liberal parties emerge able to sort of identify new folks, train those new folks, or do you foresee that happening going
forward? Actually, they did a lot. And with the help of some American-funded organizations that did training, you know, if you've never run, basic things like how do you identify your voters? How do you get your voters to the polls? I mean, it's unglamorous work. Though there was a lot of training by both the IRI and NDI, the International Republican Institute and the National Democratic Institute. But they could not, there is not one huge liberal party, and that stands to reason, or secular party. So they're going to have to get better at that, and they're going to really, this Egyptian bloc, which came in third, in other words, is the leading secular party. You know, it's got a lot of decisions to make itself, and I don't think we know how that's going to go. And certainly, a lot of seculars. I mean, at this event I went to last week, which was actually a lunch for the head of the Islamic Party that just won in the Tunisia elections, and I won't name either the affiliation of the person who said it to me, but he's a noted journalist from an Egyptian paper who was in Washington. And I said, so what's happening? You know, this was maybe Wednesday. And he just looked at me and shook his head. He said, disaster, total disaster. I mean, he's obviously secular. So there's a lot of alarm in that community in Egypt, and also, of course, among the Coptic Christians, who are 10%, about what this will mean.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the economy, because, I mean, once you have to govern, you have to deliver. And government is completely judged based on their capacity to deliver. Here you've got a population, two-thirds of the population under age 30, about a 9.4 unemployment levels before this happened.
It's probably way higher.
Way higher, yeah. It was not immune from the global economy's, you know, the crisis. In fact, it had lost maybe 40% of its foreign direct investment during that time.
Well, maybe so, though they were still doing okay, better than the rest of the world, because they had been growing so fast.
Absolutely. But the big employers have been the government and the tourist trade, yes. And is either of those sustainable over time?
Well, I think that, the government probably not, because they had this bloated civil service that nonetheless was all, you know, the party, it was all about the NDP. It was all about Mubarak's National Democratic Party. You know, it was patronage jobs. So it was bloated and inefficient and didn't deliver. And then tourism, of course, was a huge part of the economy. And not just directly tourism, but the hotels and people who, you know, there's all the knock-on things that you do. And that's just been decimated. And to this day, I mean, who would book a tour to Egypt, you know? Even though I think I could tell you that you'd be greeted with open arms, you know? It's actually a great time to go, and things are very cheap, and the people are incredibly nice, and really as long as, you know, even if you want to go a quick drive-by through Tahrir, you probably can do that if you're a tourist. But no, that's very bad. And I'll give you another example. Other parts of the business sector are being affected too. On the flight out to London, I was sitting, and I was in coach, I'll say. So this is not a high-flying guy next to me with his son. And he worked for one of the oil consortiums. So it's consortia. So there was an American company and an Egyptian oil and gas company, and another one. And I said, so how has the revolution affected your business? And he said, it's been a disaster. And I said, well, why? And he said, well, there is no one empowered to even sign contracts. So he said, we had two major exploration deals that were ready to go, but had to be approved by the government. Well, there is no parliament. There is no government. And he said, so these have been stymied. And then, of course, as you said, foreign direct investment really has plummeted. Their reserves, their foreign currency reserves are down. So the new government is going to have to deliver very quickly, which is going to be hard because it is a very inefficient economic model anyway. And the unemployment understates also the underemployment. I could tell, there's just a lot of underemployment. You'll go in a shop, and there's six people standing around, and there are no customers. I will give it'll sound like a very superficial example, but I'll give it anyway. One night I was asked to be on a television program actually run by the woman, Gamila Ismail. She has a satellite TV show, it's one of the new satellite channels. So I went out, and this is owned by one of the new tycoons. It's totally private. You'd think it would be state of the art, and it is in terms of the studio and the control room. But every room was filled with these mostly guys, you know, kind of standing around, whatever the classic is. So I went into makeup. There were five men to make me up. One guy, I'm looking at my colleague Elizabeth Farnsworth, who will know how amazing this is. So he would say, peach blush. And someone would, I'm not kidding, sponge, as if he were a surgeon. And I thought, this is unbelievable. And that is what I mean about underemployment. So everybody, in other words, has a job. They have nothing to do. And that is endemic in the Egyptian economy. So it is going to have to be a top-to-bottom overhaul.
You've interviewed a lot of the young people after the revolution. Are they right now, are they hopeful? Are they apprehensive? Are they alienated? Where are they now?
All right. When I was there in September, and I don't know where they are right now, but they were really impatient, but yet still really hopeful. And I remember saying to some of them there was another fascinating group of young people involved in this new center party, saying, well, aren't you worried about the fact that the Brotherhood is way better organized than you are, and is it too soon to go to elections? Which, of course, was originally what the secular parties were saying. You know, don't go too fast. They've got the organization. We don't. Everybody had come around. It was sort of let the games begin, and they seemed very confident. I mean, one said to me, you know, of course they're going to out-organize us, but if we don't get out there and actually have to start running, we'll never get any good. Mm-hmm. So now that may look like whistling in the dark 8 months from now if we have a very rigid code coming in through the parliament, or really through the constitutional commission that they're going to appoint. This parliament isn't going to have a huge amount of power, but they're going to help appoint the group, 100-member group that's going to write the constitution. So it's a little bit of a bank shot here, but. I would say, actually, they still feel absolutely liberated, empowered, and also proud of what they've done, mm-hmm. Very proud. Mm-hmm. And also, they have the sense that the world now respects them is just very important.
Mm-hmm. There, to a great degree, the revolution really was about dignity. So in that sense,
It absolutely was, and that's how they felt about it.
Now, this questioner wants to know about what will be the role of women. Will women come out on top of this? Will there be no change in their lives?
That is a very interesting and complicated question. I mean, on the one hand, women, are we talking in Egypt or throughout the Arab world?
The questioner is talking about Egypt.
Egypt.
Well,
no, I think in Egypt, because every country is different. But in Egypt, women, actually, there are a lot of female professionals, not just nurses, but doctors, lawyers. Women have been quite liberated and empowered in Egypt, particularly in the big cities, for a long time. You see, a lot more women are covered, but to them it's a kind of a fashion statement and also a statement of, you know, identity. And I think Westerners are overly concerned about that. That said, there's also, and particularly in the rural areas and in the more religiously conservative areas, a kind of counter-social code, which is that women, you know, more traditional view of women's role. And I know that a lot of secular Egyptians I know are actually worried about the limits that some of these conservative women place on themselves. And so I think that there's going to be, I mean, so far you don't see any moves to, certainly there have been no moves by the military leadership to limit women's rights, but I think that remains to be seen. For example, when I went to interview this Salafi candidate, who was a young architect, and his wife's a painter. He had these lovely sort of impressionist kind of paintings. And I said, oh, who did these? He said, oh, my wife. But when I started talking about what they would do if they got in power in Parliament, which at the time seemed kind of remote, yes, he believes thieves should have their hands cut off. And yes, he believes women should stay in the home and that women should have to wear a full veil. And, you know, there's going to be that segment. And so I think it remains to be seen. And, for example, the Salafis, under the law, this new temporary election law, every party had to run women candidates. So the Salafis all had a woman candidate, every district did, but they wouldn't even print a picture of her face, just a flower, because, and she couldn't be on any of the billboards. And I'll give you another example from Tunisia, where a moderate Islamist party won the elections, but the Salafis are now going into universities. This is nobody's paying attention to this, but and staging these protests about how women and men should be separated in the classroom, and that certain films being shown on campus are anti-Islamic. So there's the Salafis, and by that I mean not that they're the same in Egypt and Tunisia, but that traditional conservative fundamentalist movement is going to have a lot of energy, and they're going to try to assert themselves. So,
I mean, take us forward to the presidential elections, because there are at least two people we're aware of are international figures. One is Al-Baradei, Mohammed Al-Baradei of the International Atomic Energy Agency, and the other is Amr Moussa, who was the head of the Arab League for a decade.
Before that,
he was UN ambassador, and he was
foreign minister.
With Al-Baradei, he's a very respected figure internationally. Is he seen as authentic domestically?
He is. And the reason he is that he came back before the revolution and then joined the revolution when actually it was considered risky to do so. That is, politically risky. And so, yes, he does have a lot of respect. That said, nobody has more than, 18-20% in the polls. Same with Amr Moussa. Amr Moussa, I think, is going to have a harder time. He'll be seen as closer to the Mubarak regime because he served them for a very long time, though as a diplomat. That said, the Egyptians, including the Brotherhood, are very conscious that they need international investment. So the question is, to what degree will it also be a pragmatic choice, which is, as president, we need a figure that is reassuring to the world. And there is no younger figure. You know, Mubarak didn't let, it's what they used to say about the old Mayor Daley. He didn't let, the big oak didn't let any acorns flourish for a reason. And that was the same with Mubarak. That's why it's no accident that Moussa and Al-Baradei both made their reputations in a way internationally. They weren't trying to be active politically. So, you have, and actually now there are only 7 months till the presidential election. So even if a figure starts to emerge from the Brotherhood, let's say, in the parliament, I think it would be hard for them to get enough of a national reputation. So one of those two men might be elected, but that said, I'm not in the predicting business domestically or overseas, We just don't know yet.
So one of the question cards relates to Israel. There's been this 30-year peace between Egypt and Israel, the Camp David Accords. What is the fate of the Camp David Accords
and the peace treaty?
this post-Mubarak era?
The Brotherhood will say they don't, other than some modifications, which I think makes Israelis nervous, even that word, but that they very much want to keep it in place. You don't hear from many Egyptians that they want a state of war to exist with Israel. But there was a sense, and I picked this up a lot among just ordinary Egyptians, that Mubarak was so busy pleasing the United States and working with Israel that he neglected the home front. And so there's a resentment that somehow Egypt was always the junior partner. And it isn't so much that someone could tell you what it is about the peace treaty they don't like. There's just an overall feeling that Egyptian interests were subordinated to Israeli and American interests, which are seen like this. So The Salafists, however, do talk about really renegotiating the treaty. And so there's going to be pressure, not that they've been specific about how they want to renegotiate it either. So, the Israeli, there's no doubt that Israel's becoming more isolated in the region. And that's an area that hasn't been troublesome for 30 years. And now, as I'm sure all of you know who've read the papers, they're now building a wall right along the border with Sinai, which is actually in the middle of the desert and nowhere, but just to prevent cross-border infiltration. And they're as concerned about weapons and material moving from Sinai into Gaza. I'm not sure they're going to build a wall right there, plus the underground tunnels. That's really the problem. And they certainly won't weigh down by the resort town of Taba, but they're going to basically seal the border the whole rest of the way. And that's a metaphor for how they're feeling about it.
Yeah. So take us to Yemen, because you've also been on assignment in Yemen, and there's a country that has got an extraordinary youth bulge. It's one of the poorest in the region. It actually has been safe haven for terrorists. What should we be looking out for in the news about Yemen going forward?
Yemen is a really unusual society in that it's quite, I hate to use the word primitive, but it's tribal, and it makes Egypt look light years away. And the clans and the tribes are really the determining organization there. Now, you did have also a kind of young people's protest movement, but in the end, it was the tribal structure and the rival clans that brought the firepower. This ended up being much more like Libya. Guns were involved. It's very, very different from Egypt, which was the demonstrators were peaceful and really, if the tanks started rolling in, they'd get down to pray and to rear. Totally different tactics. Libya and Yemen, what you had was essentially civil war breakout. Right now, so it depends what we care about in Yemen. If what the United States cares about is having a stable government, then what we should be looking for is that these rival clans and tribes, including, the president's, Saleh is still going to be a player there. His son and his nephew and so on, that they reach some accommodation where they can start to reassert control over much of the country, because that's the problem. You just have vast ungoverned spaces in Yemen that nobody has been controlling. We went down to Aden, the old port, and then the governor of one of the provinces, which has become no-go zone for Yemenis, Abiyan, because of Western tourists being kidnapped there, the governor actually drove in, had lunch with us at some fabulous place, and then drove us back across and gave us a little tour of Abiyan. And he had to have a pickup truck filled with, these, it reminds you of Somalia, technicals, guys with AK-47s and Kalashnikovs in the back, in front of us and behind us. And this was the governor of the province. And so, that's the problem in Yemen. And, I think it's going to continue to be a potential haven for anti-Western terrorists.
And do we have a clear view? Does the U.S. government have a clear view on what it would like to see happen in Yemen?
No. In my limited understanding, what they want is what I just described, which is let's not have a continued state of war here. Now, the U.S., which had been working hand in glove with Saleh, I have to give it credit. It moved pretty adroitly to recognize that his goose was cooked and started working very closely with the Saudis and the Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC, to get a negotiated solution and get him out. And so in that sense, there was no clinging to Saleh as, our man who's been, holding down the fort. There were no illusions about him. So, fairly deftly, actually, the U.S., I think, has worked to try to, that what they understood was instability was the worst. And so what they want is sort of the state of play I described. You're not going to have a participatory democracy in Yemen for a long time.
And one of the question cards is about Syria and asking the question of whether we would be enforce a no-fly zone there. And I broaden that question to ask whether after the UN Security Council gave the green light for NATO's actions in Libya, is it likely that you would ever see that kind of thing happen again, or at least in the near term?
Well, that has as much to do with how the Arab countries feel as anything else. The Obama administration will not push for it at all. That said, I think Turkey is going to determine. Turkey will determine what's done in Syria. And, you know, you saw the Turks go from being, they had their nose out of joint about what happened with Libya. But with Syria, you know, they were originally looking for the negotiated solution and thought they could bring Assad around. And then once Assad essentially lied to, I don't know if it was Gül who went in or whether it was actually Erdogan, but he promised one thing and didn't deliver. Wow, that was it. And now it is the Turks. Vice President Biden was just there, and it's the Turks who are talking publicly about establishing, they're not talking about no-fly yet, but establishing zones on the border where these, they don't want all the refugees in Turkey, so establishing protected zones. Well, once, you know, that's the camel's nose under the tent. That's, once you start doing that, you got to enforce it, you got to, I think they'll be they'll have to talk about air power. So, not that, I mean, so far you haven't seen Assad using air assets against demonstrators. He just hasn't needed to. But I don't think the administration's certainly not going to rush in that direction. So I think you'll have to see how really the Arab League and the Turks, the pace that they set. That said, I know that within the administration the betting is that Assad cannot hold on indefinitely.
Yeah.
You know.
I'm going to move us to some of the question cards that are on the internet's impact on journalism itself, and in fact, even your day-to-day reporting. And the first questioner asked about how your research has essentially changed as a result. You know, whether you are consulting the work of bloggers and following Twitter feeds, et cetera, as part of your source of information. And I'd also like to link that. I'll ask my own question, but answer the question card question.
Well, the answer is, of course, it's affected the way we report, and then also how we disseminate what we report. I don't spend all day reading blogs. I just can't. But what is happening in the blogosphere makes its way into the mainstream media and certainly makes its way into the research I read I get certain alerts from certain digests of various blogs or internet only. For instance, National Journal has a fantastic one, the Atlantic National Journal one. Really thoughtful pieces. Now, that isn't sending me every tweet about some topic. I don't have time to do that. Though I do want to tell an anecdote, particularly because my producer who helped generate this is in the audience, Joanne Elgart of KQED. Joanne was my producer when we went to Bahrain, and the reason we went to Bahrain in May was we wanted to go to a country where there was a revolution underway, only it wasn't working, and why? And in fact, Bahrain has the highest internet usage of all the countries that have been involved, 53%, just huge. It seems to, very highly educated, wealth, you know, it seems to have the perfect combination. Anyway, I won't go off on that, but one of the things, but the government is clamping down. The government is using force to keep this down. So one of the ways that, you know, the question was, how could we connect with the human rights community? How could we connect with the activists who were really undercover? And so Joanne sent out to Hash Bahrain, just announcing that Hash PBS NewsHour was coming to Bahrain, and did people have story ideas? And context, and we were flooded with some terrific sources and people, and both leaders, but also, as we call them, real people. Not that leaders aren't real people, but people with personal stories. Then there was, I think it's okay to say this, Skype happens to be one medium that the government could not penetrate. So we, and particularly Joanne, started communicating with people through Skype, so that when we got on the ground, we had ways to communicate with people and ways to set up interviews. And and then our story, she would always post our stories and our interviews send out a Twitter feed. And so I got in to see, I think it was the justice or interior minister, to answer all these charges about all the repression of the Shiite community. And he'd read all our stuff, you know, because it had all been tweeted to him. And there the Bahrain government's been trying to counter-tweet. So they're trying to get into the act. That's a whole other thing about how some of these repressive governments try to use it themselves. So finally, it was our second to last night, and we happened to be there the night President Obama gave his speech to the Arab world about the Arab Spring and the American response to it. And he gave it, I don't know, I can't remember the time, but it was very late at night, my time or American time. And yet I had to go on, then the news hour wanted to essentially come live to me, what's the reaction in the Arab world? Well, so we had our fixer in the hotel room watching Al Jazeera and translating, but it was, you know, I mean, how am I going to speak for the whole Arab world? It's going to be a little difficult. So Joanne invited comments through Twitter and got 110 minutes and quickly gave me a digest of what everybody was saying. And I was able to go on and sound totally knowledgeable about at least how the Bahrainis felt about the Obama speech. So it's woven its way into our reporting and our research in a lot of ways. And I think it's got a lot of growth potential, particularly to skip, you know, you need them less with leadership than you need it with ordinary people.
This questioner notes that over the internet you can get information and you can get misinformation, mm-hmm. and how do we tell the difference and help others tell the difference? And I guess I'd add to that, you know, what about the opportunity for fraud? You think about the gay girl in Damascus that turned out to be neither a girl nor gay, nor in Damascus, for that matter.
Right. No, and that's why also I don't get all excited about one tweet or one blog, but it's sort of the Wikipedia theory of, if there are enough voices, ultimately the truth will emerge. And I think that, you know, in terms of where I will not take a fact as a fact if it's just simply been in a blog. I just can't. I never do. And whether I'm doing the research myself or having someone research it, I say, look, I want this from a mainstream, solid publication. I want to know what either The Economist, The Financial Times, The New York Times, The LA Times has said about this. And I think that, because of what the PBS NewsHour does, that's our responsibility. So, which is, I'm not going to put in a tape setup nor base a question on the basis of, I just can't, a blog or a tweet.
Let's talk a little bit about how the internet is changing mainstream reporting. You know, no longer do you have kind of daily deadlines. Now you've got hourly deadlines that you can post all along. What is that doing to journalism?
I think it's less affecting me because I still have the luxury of having a few hours before going on our program to actually to do the research, to absorb it, to choose the guests, and to actually reflect, thank goodness. But for print journalists, it's really become challenging because they have to be posting, and even at a place like the New York Times, not all the time, it's not turning into a wire service, but constantly filing updates. And that all takes time away from reporting. I can't tell you, my office wanted me to do a blog for tomorrow. It's an hour and a half that you aren't on the phone talking to somebody else who has an original experience with what you're trying to report on. You can't do everything. So, and that's another reason, in my view, to read the considered things, not just the tweets, because there are journalists who are under such pressure that they're filing things that really, then later they run corrections and you just have to alert for that. But it has definitely had, I would say, in some level, in my view, a damaging effect on the quality of reporting.
What is the meaning and what is the importance of the fact that now we will have, in essence, digital archives of a narrative about an event from the protagonists or from witnesses of it, as opposed to always turning back to whatever the official narrative is years hence?
You know, I think that's terrific. Because that's like an original source. I mean, I think in that sense, let a thousand voices bloom. And you do. I mean, that's where. Well, let's. I mean, let's take what's happening in Russia. The Russian election that took, parliamentary elections that took place over the weekend, everybody, I mean, we didn't go cover it. It was like, oh, Putin's party, United Russia, they've got it so stacked. They're, of course, going to win in a landslide. I mean, the New York Times is there, but not many Western organizations are there. Well, what happened was this time the internet got active, and a lot of young people got, apparently you can go back and track it, and it's when Medvedev and Putin decided to switch jobs, you know, and that was announced. And somehow that just stuck in the craw of a lot of middle-class young people who have been very, very grateful when I was there 2 years ago, incredibly grateful for what Putin has done in terms of helping create, frankly, a consumer economy. And then this one website called Golos, which means vote, started going out and sort of videotaping or just cell phone taping election irregularities. And suddenly this whole online community was created, and you know, it's been an amazing impact, which is yesterday, as the results started coming out, it looks like Putin's party barely hung on to 50%. I don't know where it stands right this second as we're Monday night. So, and part of that was counter narratives that were out there, and evidence, mm-hmm. evidence. So I think that I have a friend who's teaching a class at Harvard this year about the role of social media in translating, as she says, passion into policy. And one of the things they did was they analyzed all the tweets from Tahrir. There's actually a great little, I don't know if it's a great little book, but it's useful, called Tweets from Tahrir. Somebody's published it. And so she just had her class analyze all the tweets. What were the themes? I mean, it was a gold mine. There were three major themes. One had to do with hope. One had to do with conveying incidents of violence. And one just had to do with kind of organizing, you know, well, let's meet here and so on and so forth. Now, that's no historian wanting to go back in 10 years could have ever recreated that. But it's essentially it's a snapshot of conversations for 18 days. So I think in the end, that's going to be great for historians, including all the blogs, the dingiest and wingiest. It's all part of the conversation. You know, it would be as if you had all the old, newspapers, whatever they call them, from the Revolutionary War era, you know, that it somehow be preserved. And you could see the debate that took place, which, of course, doesn't exist.
Let's talk a little bit about the economics of journalism in the era of social media. Newsrooms are supposed to have shrunk about 30%.
Oh, at least.
Yeah, at least. I wanted to get a sense from you of what gets lost in that. What happens to investigative journalism? What happens to international coverage? You know, what do you see ending up being the sort of the losing end of that?
Well, both the things you mentioned. Investigative reporting. I mean, it used to be that no American major newspaper worth its salt did not have an investigative team. You know, whether it was the Boston Globe or the Philadelphia Inquirer, or, you know, not to mention the New York Times or the LA Times, but all these great regional papers, the San Jose Mercury, the Sacramento Bee. I mean, all these papers had investigative teams that went out and, I mean, it sounds corny, but, you know, tried to find places of injustice or malfeasance, and it takes time. You have to devote a lot of time to working with records. It's very tedious work. There are very few papers who can afford that anymore, and that is because of the fall away of advertising. I mean, newspapers used to be able, local, I'm talking about local newspapers. I worked at the San Diego Union at one point, and you know, it's this big display ads from the department stores. We're part of the auto companies and the classified advertising that were the bread and butter of newspapers. And you look at any paper, and that has shrunk to very, very little. So, international coverage is another place. Foreign bureaus, used to be 10 or maybe even 20 newspapers in America, had some foreign bureaus. That's down to three or four.
Yeah.
The Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the LA Times, I mean, even the Chicago Tribune shut down all their international bureaus. Now, there are other The thirst for international reporting continues. You've got a lot of self-starters, freelancers out there. But you don't have the same, I have to say, I don't think you have the same quality control that you did have when you had the journalists from the newspaper on site.
And when it comes to internet journalism, the pressure is to get things out quickly.
Right?
So
yes.
it's much more publish first, ask questions later.
Yes.
I think the adage is, and if you don't know the answer, ask your readers.
Well, I don't. Yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't. I think there are still sources where you can get fabulous international coverage, but you probably can't pick up your local newspaper and find it. So, in a funny way, it's made the papers that still invest the money all the more essential. I think you were telling me before we came out here that the New York Times has huge readership in the Bay Area, and that's because I'm sure a lot of you in this room, whether you're reading it online or in the paper, still thirst for that. But it's too bad that your local paper doesn't do that anymore.
Let me take you, though, to a different...
There's a lot of giggling out there. Or a local paper doesn't do it.
As you, right now, as you're thinking about who's got the skill, who knows how the American public or publics more broadly consume information, but also how they take in highly targeted advertising, I keep thinking that skill set is resident in tech companies, but not necessarily in news companies. So I guess I'm asking, you know, are good old-fashioned news companies keeping up with that kind of new way of consuming, and particularly new way of consuming advertising?
So are you talking about sort of trying to at least get, the big challenge right now is, even though more and more people are turning to the internet to get their news, the online advertising has not figured out how to make that profitable. That's the bottom line. And yes, I mean, Time, Inc. just hired a digital person to be their, you know, new head of Time, Inc. There's this tremendous effort to somehow crack the code, but no one's figured it out yet. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, Jane, that it will come in the end so much for the media companies as the advertisers. They're as eager to figure it out. I mean, they're not eager to pay more for the display ads, but they're eager to figure out a way, how do we figure out if we're getting bang for the buck here. And so I think that the tech geniuses that are out there trying to design it are going to come from both sides.
I have at least five question cards asking about Libya. But before we turn to Libya, I did want to ask about the role, you made a reference to this earlier, the ways in which autocratic governments have figured out how to use digital media to basically identify and ferret out and silence dissidents. So what is the kind of the dark side of all this?
Well, that is the dark side. The dark side is that after being completely clueless, I mean, the Egyptian uprising, you know, if the Egyptian intelligence services had been actually reading the signals intelligence traffic, they would have known this was all, this ferment was going on, but they weren't reading it for that. That has changed, and every single government understands what the Chinese government does, which is this is the source of challenge to a regime. So one, now they're reading, you know, they're cracking and hacking and figuring out what the conversation is. In China, they use it to identify dissidents and arrest them. China is really the model for how they do it. They just forbid, you know, you cannot, the three T's, Tiananmen, Taiwan, and why am I blanking on the third? I'm doing it, Rick Perry here. Tibet, thank you very much. Thank you, sir. Tibet, you can, literally, I sat and did a piece when I was in China with the head of Google China. And I said, well, let's see if we can get Tibet. And we sat there and, you know, you just can't. So they both do it by limiting access, and then they do it by using the internet to ferret out dissidents. That said, I still, in Bahrain, actually, they called them Bahrain trolls. The government denied that they had anything to do with this. But let's just say that if people were blogging or tweeting anti-government or pro-democracy sentiments, suddenly they would be hit with a barrage of really vicious, you know, you're an animal, you hate your country, here everyone is their home phone number, go get them. I mean, it was basically threatening counter tweets. And it was there was clearly an orchestrated campaign. So it's different in every country. The reason they're able to do this is, frankly, they're buying some really great hacking technology from American companies. You know, there's a pretty open market out there. So it's a matter of the online community just trying to stay a step ahead of these governments.
Right. Your mentioning of Tibet makes me think of, in fact, we're in a world where others see the way we cover them. So I think about the anger among some Chinese youth over the way in which we covered the Tibet issue.
Oh, very much so. That there is a strong nationalistic feeling, and that Tibet is part of China. They feel very similarly about Taiwan, and that the West wants to keep China weak. I mean, not that China is weak, but it's all about, I mean, they don't understand that actually the Free Tibet movement in the United States is very much a kind of human rights and religious freedom cause. They literally don't see it. I sat down with a group of students at one of the leading universities in China, and these were all young people who had figured out ways around the censors and the block. I mean, they were able to read the New York Times online. I mean, and they were pretty frank about it. I mean, they know exactly the back doors. But you got to this topic, and they were angry is the word.
Yeah.
And in that sense, shared the view of their government.
Now, I've got three different cards with huge questions and very little time, so I'm going to do my best.
So I'll be very short. Is that my cue to be very short?
No, you be pithy is what
pithy.
We want.
That's pithy. What I tell my guests. I say, if near the end I ask you a question, I go like this, it means
pithy?
Pithy.
So the first question card is about Libya, and the question is there a power vacuum now? Who will fill it? How will it be filled?
Pithy. Well, it will be filled. Yes, there's a power vacuum, and it will be filled. I mean, that's, I don't mean to be flip about it.
It's somebody named Gaddafi.
But it's not going to be someone named Gaddafi, and I don't think it's even going to be his sons or his clan. So, I mean, there's a lot more to tell there. I mean, I can't predict what's going to happen in Libya. That said, they've got all this oil wealth. They've got a lot of Libyan exiles who are eager to help. They did work together even though you had warring different militias from different parts of the country. I think they've got some good prospects.
And is there a strong role for the diaspora? That's an interesting point.
I think, I've observed this in a lot of countries, and certainly in Afghanistan and Iraq. There are different kinds of people in the diaspora. Some really want to come in and help and, you know, become go into government or give their expertise. There are other people who want to come in and make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And then there gets to be a resentment against those people. So we can cut both ways.
The next question card is about Pakistan and the state of U.S.-Pakistan relationships right now.
And what's the question? How bad?
How bad?
Really bad.
It's basically, what do you think will be the outcome is the question card.
Well, Pakistan is really a state in deep, deep, deep trouble. And we need Pakistan very much, both for the obvious reasons. They're a nuclear state, and for access into Afghanistan, and because they're in a very unstable part of the world. And I think at this point, Jim Jones, the former National Security Advisor General Jones, was on Charlie Rose the other night. And if people are interested in Pakistan, it's worth watching if you've TiVo'd it or you can go online. He was essentially painting Pakistan. First of all, he made it clear he did not. The U.S. government totally doesn't believe they didn't know where Osama bin Laden was. And his basic message was that this is a country that doesn't know its own interests and is kind of in a slow motion self-destruct, and that it's almost, I mean, this was his view, that it's almost impossible that you can't even think that they're going to respond rationally. And again, this was his view. I'm not saying this is my view, but I would say the relationships are very, the relationship is very, very bad, and the mistrust is so deep. Somebody wrote an op-ed the other day, whose name now escapes me, just saying, you know, we ought to give up trying to use Pakistan to get to Afghanistan, just ask the Russians to do more. Let us go in and let us exit through Russia. Now, who would have thunk that, you know, we would be asking for Russia's help? They're already, do you know that 52% of all the materiel that goes into Afghanistan on the U.S. comes through Russia? But it's all the non-lethal. And so the question is, could we get our soldiers out that way? That's a pretty dire state of affairs.
long as I've been an adult, we've been worried that Pakistan would become a failed state. One day, presumably that will be true, but it's been hanging on for a very long time in a fragile state.
It has. The mistrust continues.
Yeah. And the last questioner that I'll be able to get to is asking about Iran and asking what we should make of the most recent events there, the explosion that set back some of their own research.
The killing of scientists. The Iranians believe, and I think there's no doubt, that plus the Stuxnet virus that set back there is clearly a major covert program going on. The U.S. government neither confirms nor denies this, but involving Israel, the United States, and probably the U.K. And it's sophisticated, and the whole question is, can they slow the program down enough and see if you eventually have some sort of regime change in Iran, and it's a race against the clock. And it's a race against, their scientific and technological progress and the U.S., this consortium's ability to retard it. It has certainly caused dissension, and that's how we should look, I think, at the attack on the British embassy, which is, you've got these warring factions now. You've got Ahmadinejad, and then you've got Khamenei, the supreme leader, who is extremely anti-Western. And Ahmadinejad, believe it or not, is believed by his critics to want to engage with the West. Go figure. So I think that in the short term, this will strengthen the move toward further sanctions, and there's no doubt it's having a big effect there. But again, I think the outcome is unpredictable.
Of course, Ahmadinejad's power is quite limited. Say something. You've seen him in action. Say something about...
Oh, I have. When I was there in, I'm trying to remember, it was 07 or 08, and I actually went, he gave a press conference. And, I've seen him at the UN and stuff, but that you don't really observe a foreign leader with the UN, I don't think, the way you do in their own home turf. So I went to this press conference, and the Western press sat on one side, and there were many people in this room. And he strutted on stage, and strut is the only word. And he is completely full of himself. He is a great showman. He's almost like a Louisiana Paul. I was actually sitting with David Ignatius, and he was saying, this guy's unbelievable. But here was the interesting thing. So we in the West, the women all had to be covered and so on, and our questions, of course, were all about the nuclear program and this and this and this. But the press sitting over here, which was the Iranian press, they were all standing up and saying, why are rents going up? Why are we having food shortages? Why are food prices? They were treating him like a mayor or a governor. And looking back on it, that was really revealing. And he was still batting them away, and he really enjoyed it. He loved matching wits with the reporter. And, he'd put the reporter down, and then he'd... But you could see even then that there was pressure on him. But he is very, very self-confident fellow. Mm-hmm. So I don't think he's going to back down. He may ultimately be cut off at the knees by Khamenei, but he's not going to slink away.
So please join me in thanking Margaret Warner.